Good evening. Gosh, it's nice to see everybody. Thank you for being here. Well, I guess, is anyone here for the first time this evening? Welcome. So I thought I would talk a little bit tonight about something called the Yogacara Sutra, which is was the subject of a class that Kokyo gave. And you know, it was a very kind of intellectual class. I mean, in the sense that the Yogacara Sutra is it's a very old sutra that Yogacara school, really. It's based on a series of sutras, and one of the ones that we studied is very, very old and very kind of foundational for a certain line of Zen practice that's sometimes called the mind-only school. And so tonight I want to talk about perception, our perception of the world, and changing our perception of the world. And it's that changing part that is really difficult. So I had like 12 different titles for this talk, but I ended up on Yogacara and the paper bag problem. You've probably heard that saying, you can't find your way out of a paper bag, or I can't find my way out of a paper bag. I want to talk a little bit about the paper bag problem and studying Zen. So, as you probably, many of you know, the kind of the depth of the teaching is such a profound set of practices and studies. And although it's not quite right to divide Zen practice into studying sutras, chants, studying various lineages of Zen, and then sitting meditation, sort of in my mind, that's how I think about it, is there's kind of the physical body practice and then literally the study part that we hope sort of comes together like this and surrounds us and surrounds the world, and sort of we carry it with us into everyday life. Anyway, that's the basic idea. And there are these basic concepts like emptiness, non-duality, compassion, wisdom, that we have these interpretations of that we carry into our lives, and hopefully we manifest them. And as you probably know, the emptiness teaching is one of the most profound teachings in Zen. I suppose maybe a real kind of simple, straightforward way to put it would be something like, whatever you think is true is actually an illusion. And you could find some comfort in that, or you could find discomfort in that. But you don't have a lot of control over that. And I think at different kinds of levels in our everyday lives, we grasp that and realize that. So in a way, this is kind of about that conception and perception around emptiness. That's what I want to talk about tonight. I meant to bring a paper bag, but I forgot. So that's okay. Maybe later when we do questions, I might have to put a paper bag on my head. So I want to start with a little anecdote of something that happened last Friday in my life. Usually I work up at school all day on Friday, and I happened kind of in a break between meetings to check my telephone, which could be a whole nother subject of a talk, right? Is kind of the habitual check-in type thing. And I got two pretty alarming email messages. The first was from my father. And he says, "Dear Dana, I just can't." My father, by the way, is 87. He's going to be 88 next Tuesday. And he looks like he's 70, maybe. Very, very, very youthful looking. In fact, he's Sometimes I call him up and he's out weed whacking stuff on the side of his house. And, you know, the thought of an 87-year-old person out there with a weed whacker is kind of scary, but he seems to do pretty well with it. So he writes me, he says, "Dear Dana, I cannot take care of myself anymore. I was going out to the mailbox, which is about 2 blocks away from his house, and I felt like I couldn't take another step. And then I faltered, and I felt like I couldn't take another step." He says, "So I'm really glad that's what he often says when he's going to the doctor, but I'm taking him. He says, "I'm really glad we're going to the doctor next Monday." So I'm very worried, you know, I'm thinking maybe he's had one of these transient strokes or something is about to happen. And he's never actually said to me, "I can't take care of myself." So I'm scrolling through my emails. Next email message is actually from his companion, a person who lives at his house, who he has a somewhat sort of complicated relationship with. And she writes me and says, "Dear Dana, I just wanted to let you know that your father is doing great. He eats, he watches movies, I remind him to take his medication. I've never seen him so great." And so you can imagine my kind of state of mind. I'm thinking, oh boy. Who knows what this is? And those of you who know me, you know that I've been sort of had this complicated relationship with my family, trying to figure out, you know, where to step in and step forward with my father and when to step back. And because he is elderly, you know, I have a lot of concern about how he's getting taken care of and so on. So I read these messages and I think, okay, my dad thinks he's dying and she thinks he's fine. This is really distressing. So I end up going up there, and just so you won't worry through the rest of my talk, my father's doing pretty well. Clearly he's declining physically. But he didn't die on Friday, as he seemed to think that he might. So I thought this was a really nice illustration, not to sort of, you know, enroll my own family history here in a Zen teaching, but I thought it was a really nice illustration of the way in which different perceptions of the same, you know, phenomenal world are really so very different. And in fact, what had happened was my father had walked back in the house, gone straight to his email, written me, and had not told this person that he lives with that he had this problem out on the walk. And so what is this teaching? Well, according to the Yogacara school, you know, the Yogacara mind-only philosophy has these definitions. Zen is so great, or Buddhism is so great, it always has these, you know, two or three simple things that apply to everything. And so this is one of those. These are the three things that apply to the nature of all phenomena. And the first is, I think Kokyo calls it one description is that this he calls it imputational perception, which is that we impute meanings through signs and symbols to what is going on. But other descriptions are something like fully conceptual, which sounds like a good thing, like you've thought it through. But what it really means is that it's just in your mind and that it's not really true. Like, it might have some grain of what appears to be true, but we're never really completely sure, even though we think we are sure of what's happening. So that's the first teaching of the kind of three characteristics of all phenomena. The second is a teaching about interdependence. That is, we have a recognition of dependent co-origination of all phenomena. And the third is something that's called fully accomplished understanding, which is basically a teaching on suchness, right? That you can see through the illusory nature of all what appears to be our conceptual idea of phenomena, and you come back and you see underneath that or aside to that, or you see behind that the true nature of being. And Dogen calls it, for example, suchness, and we sometimes refer to it as such as well. And these modes of perception, whether you believe them or not, at least according to the Yogacara school, and I think more generally in Zen practice, these are a kind of, this is what brings us together. In fact, none of us would probably be in this room had we not already had some understanding of these three modes of understanding the characteristics of all phenomena. So one of the cool features of this mind-only school, this is, you know, we're like use words to describe very profound concepts about how we see reality and what's problematic about our views of reality. And, you know, when we leave it kind of at the study level, it sort of sits at that level. And I, in my view, it's we often as Zen practitioners don't get together and talk about what the application of that looks like or what the realization of that looks like in our own everyday lives with our families, with our colleagues and co-workers, with people that we meet on the street and so on. And I have this kind of whole section in here where I talk about this and some of the academic work I do, but as I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, I don't actually really want to talk about my academic work. So one of the things that I wanted to express tonight is my own difficulty with this practice. And I anticipate that some of you will say, oh, Dana, that's what makes you human. What a relief. But actually, I feel that this is a real constitutional difficulty I have with the mind-only school, with Zen practice. I don't think it, I should say as a kind of preface, I don't think this dooms me as a Zen student, but let me try and describe to you what that difficulty is. That is that in Zen practice, these three characteristic of all phenomena that exist, whether we like it or not, we really aspire to get to this thoroughly established nature of all things, or what the Yogacara school calls the fully accomplished nature of things, characteristic of things. That is to get right down to suchness, because honestly, that's what brings us here. And we're also trying, part of what we do when we study and we sit, we chant, when we do service, when we practice, is we're trying to kind of bust apart or at least become aware of our own kind of delusionary tendencies around how we perceive the world. So ideally, you know, as we become more practiced in this, in Zen practice in Buddhism, we would be less likely to have something like what would happen, what my father and his housemate reported, which were two completely different versions of what appeared to be, you know, a very kind of proximate living together. And one of the ways that we try to do this is we try to use our intention, our practice, our meditation, as a way to, in some ways, affirm to ourselves that what we think is true may not, in fact, be true. That our ideas about this person as a good person, bad person, problematic person, difficult person, annoying person. I mean, usually it goes to these kind of afflictive states when we're kind of working with our own practice around this, like, oh, you are so annoying, kind of thing. We don't usually kind of, we're not called to Zen practice when we say, I am so happy with you, I love you so much. You are just perfect for me. That usually doesn't create the conditions under which we go, let me practice some of the mind-only school. So one of the ways that I've always heard that it's useful to practice with kind of changing our afflictive perceptions of the world in which we live is to change our intention. And that is to just kind of move 5 degrees perception-wise to the right or to the left. So if you're about to say, oh, that is such an annoying person, or this person is really irritating me, you could go anywhere from, let me see why I am having such a difficult time, to let me try and change my perception of this person that they're not actually really annoying me. That person, no, I'm just kidding. It's not that person, it's that person. That person's not really annoying me, but I am having difficulty because of A, B, and C. Right? It's a kind of self-reflective process that we might undertake in order to come closer to the thoroughly established nature of all being. That is, to come closer to suchness and move further away from our ideas of a situation, which oftentimes, particularly if we're in critique mode, are wrong. Okay, so I just have a heck of a time with this, which is I can sit through hours and hours of on the cushion saying, I will not think that, I will try to change that. No, that person's not an annoying person, they are this kind of person. I am not annoyed, I am actually, you know, in pain, or I go through all of the what I think are, or what I hear from my fellow Zen practitioners, from many of you and many others, that I could change this if only I had the proper practice, intention, concentration, focus to alter what I am discursively saying in my mind. Okay, so maybe I'm not actually saying to someone, ooh, you're really irritating to me. Maybe I'm saying it just silently to myself, but I'm suffering for it nonetheless, right? Because I'm kind of holding a little stress and tension in my body. So when I try to change that, I have some difficulty with that. And it's a little bit like being faced with a ball of string that's just knotted up, and trying to find the right end to clean it up and pull it into a straight line. Or the way I like to think of it, at least for the purposes of this talk, is it's like putting a paper bag over my head and I can't figure out which way is up or down or out of the bag. And I just kind of futz around in this bag for days, for hours, for years, really. And I know actually people in our Sangha who can just change their perception a little bit like this, and it looks different to them. And I see it in their bodies, in their persona, in their selves, that they can relax into a different perceptive situation. And it's so interesting to me that I can't do that, and I honestly have been kind of whacking myself for years about this. Like, come on, Dana. Focus. Change that intention. Work on it, you know. Work with me, Dana. We're trying to get through this. And honestly, there's almost no amount of working with myself analytically, in my mind, intellectually, perceptually about it, that will get me out of it. And it's a really interesting thing, because I've just struggled with this for years. So I just want to give you a couple examples of how my mind works. And you can in the future say, Dana, how's the paper bag thing going? So imagine, for example, let me just give you a hypothetical example. This is not a real example. That someone owes me money. I know. For some reason, I think immediately someone will go, well, are we talking about a small amount of money or a big amount of money? It's some money. And let's say I buy tickets to something and I meet a friend and the friend says, oh, hey, I'm sorry, I don't have the $20, so I will give it to you later. And I say, okay. And so then over the course of that night, more money gets spent and more money is promised back and no money ever comes. Like a week passes, 2 weeks pass, 3 weeks pass, a month pass, 6 months, years. And this is how my mind works. I go, well, they meant to pay me the money, but they forgot. I could ask them, but I'm embarrassed for them because I would probably not do that. And so they must be embarrassed, and maybe it's just some process that they're going through. And I probably make more money than they do anyway, so I should just forget this. And so then, you know, another 3 weeks, 2 months pass, and I'm thinking, well, now there's the added layer of time. So someone might say to me, well, ask them. Just say, hey, remember that $20? Remember that $20,000 you owe me? But I would be embarrassed to do that. And because I wouldn't be, I would imagine that they would be embarrassed. And now there's this added layer of time that has passed, which has added this other kind of, in my mind, a layer of misunderstanding, which is now, well, why didn't you ask about it earlier? Why now? Well, I had it 6 months ago, but I don't really have it anymore, and so on like that. So it's a little bit like, okay, why don't I just like sit down and put a paper bag over my head, because I'm never going to work this out in my mind. And even though, let's just say 5 years passes, and I haven't forgotten about it, and maybe I don't expect that they owe it to me anymore even, but it's one of those areas where would I lend them money again? I don't know. I might. Who knows? But I've been thinking about it in this, in my mind. And I want to say it's not really about the money, it's about some social process of engagement. And maybe it's about kind of having and finding the appropriate boundaries of relationship in which various kinds of things get exchanged. Friendship, love, money, things, favors, and so on. But I don't want you to think it's just about things. So I just want to give you another example, which is has to do with writing. And I'll have to, this is a little bit of a confession, but I have a hard time writing, which is a really funny thing for an academic to have, since my job is to write. And this is how my mind works about it. When I'm writing big things like articles or books, I can't talk about it. And in fact, even to myself, I can't say, I'm writing a book. Because right then and there, when I say that to myself, or if I say it to you, then my mind starts to move in directions that I can't really control. And it becomes like this knotted ball of fishing wire. And I'm just, pretty soon I'm just reaching for the paper bag. So when I do write, I never talk about it because I can't say that I'm writing, because it creates in my mind this whole kind of discursive talk with myself about the intellectual activity of writing. Now, I don't know if you know people who have been in PhD programs or have had the misfortune of possibly living with someone who's been in a PhD program, but I think most people have this. There are very few people who just sit down and write. I currently have a graduate student who, she says, I'm working on this, and then she produces it on the day that she says she was going to produce it. She gets a lot of feedback from her committee members, and she's completely non-defensive and says, oh, okay, I get it. Then she goes back and fixes it and comes back again. Maybe I've had two people like that in 25 years of teaching. Most people have the problem that I have, which is why I often like to say, you know, most of us are just ordinary. Our problems are other people's problems. And it always kind of haunts me that Suzuki Roshi said, the problems you have now, those are the problems that you'll have for the rest of your life. I wish I had heard that in graduate school, you know. Maybe I would have been something else or done something else. But now that I'm on both sides of the desk, that is, I'm writing my own work and I'm working with students and supervising students and reading people's work that's like my colleagues, that's to be published in book series and journals and stuff like that. I'm very aware that this is a very individualized practice in writing and talking about writing or exchanging through emails or commentary about writing. So, for example, you know, most faculty I know, we want to be encouraging, right? You never say something like, this is the worst stuff I've read in 25 years. Who let you into graduate school? That's a terrible thing to say. You know, that's a little bit like going like this. Kind of checking to make sure they're completely down. Instead, you're more likely to say something like, you know, this is really good. It has a lot of promise, and here's where I think some things could change. I want you to think about these things. Listen to what the other people are saying, too, and then let's talk about it. Well, I know from having been a graduate student that when you get comments like that, it's some people are like, you know, it's like this choking experience, like, oh my God, it's not perfect. I have to turn around and do these other things to it. And then sometimes people will read those comments and they'll think, wow, it's great, she liked it. That's great, I'm going to turn it in now. And that's sort of problematic too. So, you know, in the interaction with students, it's always this, it's a dance, right, of interaction in which we're thinking, as we all are really in our lives, with our families, with our friends, with colleagues, about the nature of the interaction, right? So it's just that when I get in that interaction, I get stuck in it. So the whole world of perceptual thinking and processing that perceptual thinking, if I start there with, let me see how I should approach this student or this this faculty member or this person in my family, it's like ball of string, you know, inside the paper bag. Let me just carry the paper bag around with me because I might have to put it on my head at any given moment. And, you know, I'm mentioning this to you tonight because I wanted to suggest that for those of us who cannot, by intention or by will or through meditation or through chanting or through whatever practices that we have, kind of work in the area of perception of the world in which we live by changing it like this in our minds, I think that there are other things that we could do. And I just wanted to say that it's taken me a long time to realize that I am not one of those people. And I've really only just realized this. And now, you know, I went through graduate school. I've been a professor for 25 years. I feel lucky that I see this now. But here's what I think does work for me, that allows me to kind of work in, kind of working around the different perceptual kind of ways or modes of seeing the world and the characteristic of all phenomena. And my analogy would be something like a desktop. All of you have computers, I presume, or have been on one lately. So, you know, in your desktop, you have this option to organize your desktop, right, into little file folders or to hide it all on the hard drive or to put these kind of icons in your, what's it called, your menu bar. And I can't stand a messy desktop. Like, structure for me is something that is like this. It comes effortlessly and without thinking. So if you were to look at my desktop, what you would see is all these folders. And there are very few, for example, documents or PDFs or things that don't have a home. It's a little bit like having your socks arranged by color in the drawer or something, or, you know, whatever way that we kind of approach, in some ways, really the mundane things in our life. And I happened to, I was at a conference in at a law school a few weeks ago in LA, and I happened to sit behind, you know how in law schools they have those long tables, and So I was sitting kind of at the back, and I could see all these people in front of, in rows in front of me with their desktops open. And I would say about half of the people had these desktops that to me were a nightmare. Like they had files sort of overlapping other files and folders, and you know, you couldn't really, from where I sat, find anything or view anything because it was all like this desktop extravaganza of files. And I think that for some people, it's not that they haven't had time to organize their desktop, it's just that that doesn't bother them. That's fine. They know where it is. They know what's pending. They know what the kind of process is for them to kind of organize their stuff in their mind. So their kind of perceptual approach to thinking about organizing the world is it's not a matter of the file folders. And this is kind of a, maybe a little bit of a kind of banal example, but I you know, it's not tenable for me. And my process in order to be able to change things like small perceptions in my life about things that are frustrating, that are annoying, that things that I don't know, things that are complicated for me relationship-wise, is I put it on my desktop. No, it's that I need to have some kind of structure and organization, and then oftentimes maybe a list that flows from that, that I just go down that list. So I'm not really thinking about the list, I'm just going down the list. And all of us, right, make lists. Many people do that usually during Zazen, right? After I get out of here, I'm going to do this and this and this and this, right? And some of us make those lists, and we don't necessarily put it in a particular order. And then we sort of, as we're doing it, pick out the things that are important. That I'm saying that kind of process I can't do on the fly. That's like, hand me the paper bag. I'm going to put it over my head right now. But other people, they make that list and they organize their lives in ways that they can do it. To me, it appears on the fly. And I envy that process, but I also feel like now I have an understanding of why that process doesn't work for me, because my mind goes berserk with things like so-and-so owes me money and 20 years pass, and I'm still wondering exactly what happened. Like it's not, and as I said, it's not about the money, and it's not about, I do this with my graduate students too. Someone, I write them comments on their dissertation, and they say, thanks, I'm really glad you like it. And I thought I wrote something completely different. But I, you know, as a graduate student, it's a very difficult existence to have these three or four people sort of determining your future, so you want to be very careful about the communication that you have with them. And and kind of do your best to cultivate their scholarly development. So then I think, well, they didn't really get it that I was criticizing them. Should I go back and tell them that actually I was criticizing them? How would I do that exactly and not be blunt about it? And go like this to them, which is the last thing that I really want to do. And so then I start to think about that next round of exchange over email, and I go get the paper bag. Because I'll think, well, I'm going to think about this when I have a little more time to sort it out. Like maybe I don't have enough time to think about this. And so it's a kind of a, it becomes one of these areas of my life where there's a lot that's left undone. That could be done. So this is kind of a long way of saying that as we practice, and particularly in the areas that we have difficulty, whether that be with people or with work or whatever, with our health, with our lives, with our families, the teaching that we could change that by moving this way, I think that works for some of us. I know it doesn't work for me. And I wanted to say that as a way to kind of liberate all people who have those kind of compulsive looking desktops like me. And this does actually have something to do with my father, which is who I started with. You know, I think what I'm saying, and this will sound a little bit odd, particularly if people listen to part of this talk, but not all of the talk, that in order for me to get out of my paper bag, I have to, in some ways, model my life after my desktop. That the place where it's effortless for me is the place that brings me deeper in to Zen practice, to the Yogacara school, to the mind-only school. So over the past few years with my father, I wanted to start with him because I thought it was just such an illustrative example of the ways in which different people see a pretty proximate reality so dramatically differently. Over the past few years, you know, I've gone back and forth with wanting to help my dad as he gets older, and wanting to care for him and to help him with the things that are failing, his health, his memory, his relationships. And I realize now that that's been a pretty good way to have a good paper bag over my head most of the time. I should be taking a paper bag up to Oakland every time I go. And that he and his living companion have, or live-in companion, have such different views of the world is not news to me. I've known about this for probably at least 6 years. And it's been quite acute in the last few years. And it's been often very frustrating and confusing, and I think you can probably imagine you'd want to step in and figure out what the truth of this is. Did you actually give my father dinner or not? Did you actually give him medication or not? Should I be having someone else give him medication? These are sort of the very practical kinds of questions that I've been very much concerned with. And as I reflect on this, I realize that in a way, my kind of search for the truth of this has been, it's not so important, really. And in fact, my dad was, I think, in his own way, showing me his own kind of structural arrangement of this issue. He was showing me his desktop, as it were. That's how I kind of think about it. When I saw him on Friday night, he said, you know, I thought I was going to die. And I feel this kind of slipping. And I know for a fact, because I spent a fair amount of time with him over the weekend, that he didn't actually say that to his companion, the person who lives with him. And when I went with him again to the doctor on Monday, he didn't say it to the doctor. But I know that this is kind of, as he's losing his memory, losing his ability to care for himself, this is where all of our minds would go, right? Is this what death looks like? Is this what the beginning of the end looks like? And he was, I think, in his own way, dismissing the minor truths that we struggle with. Is it true that he got his medications? Is it true that he ate? Is it true that he actually watched the whole movie, or did he just take it out of the player and return it? All of that stuff is really not that meaningful. And he was, in dismissing these minor truths about perception, about changing it from here to here, he was showing me, I thought, some, what does Kokyo call it, like the thoroughly established character of being. And it's kind of I'm not quite sure I'm explaining this very well, but I wanted to kind of move around this notion that, in a way, when he said to me, I thought I might die on Friday morning, he was saying, you know, life really changes from now on. The acknowledgement of this, in a way, is such an expression of suchness, of the thoroughly established nature of being, that it just kind of cut through all the paper bag stuff. And I had to take the paper bag off my head. I can't really say to him, Dad, you're not going to die. That's, you know, when you're just about 88 and in pretty good health, but, you know, it wouldn't be surprising if he had a stroke or a heart attack or something one of these days. But when he put it on the table like that, or put it on the desktop, it kind of reorganized all this other stuff around, wow, I got these two really strange emails today. So it was really a tremendous gift that that I think we don't often get to have with one another. Because, you know, I could be sitting here thinking about, wow, that guy owes me $20. And then even if I say, it's not about the money, and 10 years later I'm thinking, well, I really got in a whole paper bag thing about processing that. In a way, that stuff's not really important. And would I lend him the $20 again? Yeah, I probably would. Would I write my students differently than I do, even though maybe they misunderstand me? I'd probably do the same thing. And so it's a, for me, this whole thing has been a kind of lesson in process. And it's taken actually until, the Yogacara class was 6 classes or 8 classes, much of which I listened to online. I had this kind of virtual experience of it. But I've always had these questions about, yeah, but my mind goes here. And as much as I try to put a leash on it and bring it back over here, it's hard to do that. And I know some people can do that very easily. I remember, not to name names, but when Carl Christensen was Shuso, head student, he talked about just changing your perception slightly and changing, in some ways, the world around you. And it was such a beautiful talk. And I am still so jealous that he can do that, because I will just go for the paper bag right away. Thank you. So I didn't bring my paper bag, but I guess we could try to have some discussion or questions about this if you'd like. Jean. That's a good question. I think I've just had a moment where I could see what was happening when I put the bag on. Like, I have never to this day ever thought of myself as, if I'm understanding your question right, you'll have to let me know. I've never thought of myself as having a paper bag over my head. And so there was something about kind of the combination of both the class and the material and kind of the daily events in my life that have brought me to kind of think about this analogy of the paper bag. It's a little bit like every now and then the universe turns us. So every now and then, just recently, I saw that I had a paper bag on my head. Sometimes.
So proceeding the process of bag allows you to see sometimes perception is narrow and sometimes it's maybe a little bit more full or wide.
Yeah. I think it's also about, we want to be at that place where perception is full and wide. And we know that that place exists intellectually, and some of us know it in a very kind of visceral, embodied kind of way. And we always are wanting to bring that closer together like this. And it's that whatever process we go through individually to bring those things together. That is, I think, what I've been talking about. And maybe my first step is to just say, wow, I have a paper bag over my head. No wonder I can't get over here. Let me see if I can get over here a different way. Tell me how your desktops are organized. Sally?
In my experience, sometimes I can change my perception, my thoughts, and that changes the world. And other times it's more changing my mood changes my perception, my thoughts, and my mood state. Mm-hmm. So nothing, I haven't, you know, changed the thoughts, but it just happens because the mood state changes.
Right. So how do you change your moods? So changing your behavior by engaging in something in which you're more connected.
Yeah. And then it just happens, and then just all of a sudden, and then the perception, you know, the thoughts
right.
are different.
Well, I think that's a really good example of how if you try to get at it directly, that's hard. But if you get at it obliquely, it's possible. How much would you like? Thank you very much.
Surpassable. I bow.